Accession number 28359, Reel 2.
Roy Gibbs, Reel 2. Roy, so you said you're working, assisting this chap who's the Western Front correspondent. And was he travelling back and forward from the Daily Express in London to France and Belgium?
Yeah. Yes, he was travelling backwards and forwards. He spent more time probably there than he did actually in the office.
And he was sending dispatches back to the office?
You must remember, of course, communications weren't as good as they are today. And telephonic communications being interrupted by lines being down from the bombing and so on. So he did have to come back fairly frequently to write up his stuff.
What were you doing in the office when he was sending this stuff back? What was your job?
Well, all sorts of little local stories about... I got to the stage where I was standing in for the more senior correspondents who are no longer there. I mean, they've gone, will you go and cover something that's happening in North London or go south of the river and do so-and-so, and there was an incident in the docks, can you go and find out about that? It was all really a very good training ground. Nobody ever taught me to write, but I think it was something you acquired by hard experience.
And at the time, where was the Daily Express situated?
Fleet Street.
It was on Fleet Street. So you were seeing a lot of wartime London at this time?
Very much so, yeah, because one needed to get one sent the story, you had to get there, you know. Spent a lot of time walking, because transport wasn't all that good either at times.
Roughly, can you remember the time you were at the Express? What was roughly the month and the year that you joined it?
I was 15 and a half in 39 when the war actually broke out. I think I joined them almost immediately, in the October, I think, because this job was going. Stayed with them until I was called up when I was about 17 and a quarter.
So during this period, you were very aware then, if you were at the newspaper, of the events of the war?
Oh, very much so, yeah. You couldn't not be aware, actually, especially when things like you got to the office in the morning and there's a landmine dangling from the lamppost in Ludgate Circus, you know. So.
Tell me about that.
Well, just the... I used to use my bicycle a lot to get to Fleet Street because it got me around, of course, around London. And the road was blocked off, and I said, I've got to get in. Yeah, it's most important I get in. I'm a journalist. Yeah. He said, you can go if you want to, sir. He said, but, sir, I was only a boy. I must warn you, there's a landmine hanging from the lamppost in Ludgate Circus, so I think I decided to give it best for the time being, and found my way into, I think, probably a Joe Lyons for a cup of tea or something. And eventually went in the back entrance in Shoe Lane, and it was still dangling from the... We were on the first floor at the time, and you could see down Fleet Street, and you could see this thing still swinging. Which.
So what were the differences? What was the difference between a landmine and a straightforward bomb?
Well, a straightforward bomb would, once it was dropped, would have a little propeller type thing on the... I would describe as the back end of the bomb, the fin, with the fins to direct it, and this propeller, which with the airflow slowly unwound so that when it hit, it exploded. And of course, there were time delays. The propeller, this little propeller function was fixed so that it didn't uncoil completely, and the bomb dropped and then went off about 10 minutes later, when everybody was coming, the AR people and so on, bomb disposal were coming around, blew up in their faces. But a landmine was actually dropped by parachute, and this was rather like a sea mine. It had things that came out, protuberances, I think you'd call them. The minute they touched anything, boof, up she went. It was dropped by parachute. I think the idea was that the trouble with bombs is they tended to bury themselves when they landed, and therefore the damage from the blast wasn't as much. With the landmine, it exploded immediately on impact, and the blast went outwards and therefore did more damage and caused more deaths. Is that, I'm not very good at technical explanations of that nature, but...
So this one, of course, hadn't hit the ground because its
parachute... No, it was swinging from by its parachute. From
the caught it on the lamp post.
Very difficult for the bomb disposal squad to get at it and do anything.
Did you watch? Could you see them doing this at all? While you were, did you keep going to the window from work and having a look to see?
Yeah, the express building is some little distance from where this actually was, but you could see the figures moving about, and they'd sort of got as far as you could see, they got ladders up the lampposts. There's those very tall city lampposts they were, of course. And you could just occasionally you'd see this thing swinging in the breeze, which especially as the Daily Express was an all glass building, if you recall. It wasn't a good thing to be hanging out of the windows. You were much safer at the back where the printers were.
So, part of your other job, while you were there, I mean, presumably you were there when the war at the time wasn't going in the favour of the British. How was the feeling? What was the morale like? The atmosphere in the not only in at the Express, but wherever you went in London or back with your parents.
Well, I get very cross these days when I read historians who come out with things like the public were nearly defeated and the morale was terrible, it was low. I mean, that is absolute nonsense. The morale was high, very high in the circumstances, but people weren't downhearted. They were very angry at Hitler and his cohorts. They thought we were, time that tide turned in our favour, they were doing rather too well. But the general public were marvellous. I get very cross. Historians will sort of say these things, and quite often they're young people who don't know and didn't live in that period, and where they've gathered information from, I think, is probably from books and assumption. I'm sure people were being bombed day and night, they were living in shelters at night, but they were still going to work during the day. The shops were, and their fronts blown out. The famous thing was, they used to put up a boarding, "We are open," chalk it up, and everybody was got, and the worse it got, the more the shoulders were to the wheel. Everybody was determined that Hitler was going to be defeated. And I think it's quite wrong to say that people, were down in the dumps and ready to give in. So I don't personally think they were, but of course I was away myself at the back end of it, so whether it situation got worse, but I don't think so, not from conversations I've had with people like my own parents and their generation who were there,
Even after Dunkirk, when the Britain was essentially alone and the Germans were on the French coast, would you say there was still a feeling that people thought, well...
There's a feeling of determination. I mean, take the Home Guard, after Churchill's speech, we'll fight them on the beaches. All these old boys came forward. I mean, a lot of them were veterans of the 1418 war, and even before. They had no uniforms at first, no weapons. They had broomsticks with knives tied to them. There was a spirit of determination that we were going to win this fight. A lot of reasons probably why we did, but I don't think it was certainly the morale of the general public. They went through hell. I mean, homeless, a lot of them, living like troglodytes. But always determined, and as far as sort of younger men of my age that were still at home and hadn't gone away yet, they were just determined to get in and do their bit.
Just last thing, Roy, about the Daily Express. Going back to the scoutmaster who got you the job there, had he worked there in the past? Did he have some sort of connection?
I never knew the connection. I think he had a lot of contacts in Fleet Street from boys who'd been scouts under him. And he used to use them unmercifully to find people jobs. In fact, years later, he got on to me about the same thing. He said, I did it for you, now you can do it for some of my lads. And this was years later.
Did you manage to help him out?
Yes, found him. Job for a few of his lads.
Excellent. So going back to you're doing all this training in the air training corps at weekends and what have you at the old school. you want to be a pilot. And did you say at first you naturally thought it was going to be the RAF?
Well, this is the assumption. The Air Training Corps was formed to provide manpower for the RAF. And the fleet air arm thing was purely incidental. I mean, I even found later on when I was in it, people knew very little about the fleet air arm. I think it's only since the Falklands that people have actually known anything much about the fleet air arm. It's partly, I think, because of the senior service attitude. We don't blow our own trumpet. But people just didn't seem to know about it. I had great trouble. I remember coming back from Canada, I digress again, but after I'd just completed my training with some of the other lads, about 20 of us, and we had our first set of wings, our gold wings, which we were on the sleeve. RAF blokes were going back. They said, "What are you chaps?" And we said, "Well, we're collecting stair gunners." "Don't be silly. Sailors don't fly." People got very confused. Sailors didn't fly. They went to sea in ships.
Of course, because you were wearing a Royal Navy uniform.
Yeah, you're wearing a Navy uniform.
Okay, so you're at the moment you're desperate to want to be in the RAF. Were you at this period in the Air Training Corps? Were you in it while the Battle of Britain was happening?
Yeah, must have been.
Do you remember much of the Battle of Britain? Do you remember seeing anything in particular?
Again, obviously the job I was doing in Fleet Street, you got all these claims of how many were shot down and the terrible things that were going on. Living in North London, I think the sort of fighting in the sky was more over Kent, and people saw the battle going on in the sky. But yeah, you were terribly aware of everything that was going on, really. I mean, it was the whole nation was involved by now. Yeah, we'd had our bad time, we'd had Dunkirk, we'd had the retreat from France, we'd retreated in the desert, we'd had a hiding wherever we were, we'd had a hiding in Greece, we'd had a hiding in Crete. And it seemed that the more that we were beaten, the more determined we got getting to win, you know, that the morale was there, even if we hadn't got the wherewithal very much.
So you were telling me that you're on this train journey out to Hampshire,
mm-hmm.
and there are these chaps on the train, the fleet air arm, and up until that point you didn't know who they were.
No, I mean, all our training, as far as we were concerned, we were training for the RAF. And so this really fascinated me. And when I got back, I talked to another particularly close friend of mine in the Air Training Corps, and we both put in for it. He unfortunately failed, but he did finish up in the RAF years later.
What was it about it? What was it that fascinated you about the fleet air arm at that time?
I always had this slight feeling for adventure, and it seemed different. I thought, yeah, flying from a ship is something quite different, and I'd like a basin full of this if I can get in. Not because I was in it, but the standards were much higher. It was much harder to get in because it was a much smaller service at that time, with very antiquated aircraft.
So you and your friend have this discussion when you get back to London.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you said you sent a coupon away.
Yeah, I filled in a coupon. Said, advertising this. It's called the Royal Naval Y Scheme for aircrew.
Y is as in the letter Y.
Youth Scheme, yeah. Y
Scheme.
Well, it's actually called the Y Scheme. You know.
Right. It stood for youth.
When you passed, if you were in the ATC, you got a special badge which you were very proud of. You wear on your arm that. Said you were a member of this, and you could also wear the old white RAF white flash, of course, that you were trainee air crew by then. All very posh. very glamorous.
Yes. And then, so you then said you then had an invitation to go up to the Admiralty.
Yeah, well, just you were asked to attend an interview. No idea what was involved. You weren't given any warning. And
did you go up in your Air Training Corps uniform?
You're dressed very carefully in your best suit, suitably groomed. And I said, there's just this, well, it looked like a room full of gold braid, is the only way I can describe it.
When you approached the Admiralty at that time, what did it look like outside?
The interviews were actually held in, I think it was Queen Anne's Mansions, at the back. So I assume that some offices had been seconded to the flea down. And I remember for the medical, I had to walk across St James's Park there and to somewhere else to have the medical.
So you turned up, did you have to present your letter to a secretary?
Yes, you just went in and they made quite a fuss. You actually, a wren, you know, took it and disappeared and said, "Will you come this way, sir?" That was the first and only time I think I was ever called sir by a wren. So, and it was a very sort of very stringent examination, your background.
And it was a verbal examination?
Yeah, verbal examination. Your background, what you've done, it said, it touched on trigonometry, it touched on algebra. Geometry, the whole lot they covered. You know, the questions being shot at you from sort of four different directions, and very, very tough. It really was. Yeah, you thought, oh, I'm about to fail this. You know?
And presumably, your answers came from the subjects that you've been taught in the training course.
Well, a combination of that and what you've learned at school.
Right.
The beauty about the training course. Training was that it was an addition to the training you'd already had in normal school, the academic subjects and so on. You know, my shorthand and typing skills, obviously, I was using day to day anyway in my job, but they weren't terribly interested in that. It was very much about the family as well. I found out why later on, of course, with the Navy is. I don't know about now, but they were very snobbish on families.
It was your social background
yeah.
they were interested in. And did it...
Well, originally the promise was that all air crews would get commissions in the fleet air arm. This transpired to be very wrong. It found out they had non-commissioned air crews just as much as they did... But so it was really, this was probably the social background, the fact that you know, if you were going to be an officer, you had to know which knife and fork to use.
And did you feel that with your father being he was a businessman essentially, he ran his own business. Do you think it went against you or for you in this line of questioning?
I think in mere fact he was a director of his own company and his... You know, had been his father's father before him, it went for me. At least I got that impression, as I recall. You know, I hadn't come from the bottom of the barrel. I think possibly a better school might have helped a bit more, but they couldn't quite understand the concept, I don't think, of this new type of education.
Yes, I can imagine that, yes. So, off you go, and what do they say? Will they be in touch with you?
Yep. Yeah, you'll be called to colours in due course, I think was the actual phrasing they used. And yeah, I went back and continued my training.
But at this time you thought, oh, well, that's it. They're going to
oh, yes, call you're actually given a certificate saying that you are now a member of the Royal Naval Air Service, or Fleet Air Arm as they called it. You have been... seconded to the reserve until your services are required, and you had this certificate which you actually needed because conscription was coming up for young men then. And I remember I actually did have to attend, I had to go along to this conscription meeting, and I had to show them my certificate, say, I'm already in the armed services, which you were. I mean, you've been released to reserve pro term, you know. That didn't go down too well with the lady that was recruiting gentlemen for the army, because she took one look at me and said, not a pleasant lady, rather typical, I think, of the people who did that sort of job. And, well, I can tell you right now, there's no chance you'll get in the Air Force, no chance you'll get in the Navy, you are for the army. And I took great light, so I'm terribly sorry, madam, but I am already in the Navy. I produced my certificate, didn't you?
And what were the circumstances around that? Did you get a letter at home saying you must attend a conscription meeting?
Oh yeah, I suppose your Americanism would be the draft. Your draft card came up. Yeah, that was it. You were due for conscription. They took people right down to 17 in the end. And you just had to go along, and if you weren't already in anything, I mean, some of the guys in the RAF, I think, got released to the VR if they joined an earlier age, so they were exempt because they were already part of the armed services. But you just had to go. It was there's no dodging. I suppose there were conscientious objectors. There must have been, but there wasn't much chance to get. I don't think anybody wanted to go get out of it much. It's only the, as I say, we're all. To us, we wanted to do our bit, and we were keen, and this was, still a great big adventure. The realisation comes home later.
When you went home after the Admiralty with your certificate, what was the reaction of your parents?
Well, mothers are always upset. I think my father realised I was going to have to go anyway, and I thought I'd probably at least going into what was my own choice, but... Needless to say, mother cried, and they always did. They cried over everything. See my own wife do it now. Over grandchildren, over children.
And during this period, did you continue with the Air Training Corps?
Yeah, I continued with the Air Training Corps, and with my job. And I can't quite remember how long. It wasn't terribly long before I got my letter to report to HMS Royal Arthur at Skegness.
And what, can you remember what time that was? What year or what month?
Oh, yeah. It must have been about... November, I think. November 42. And I had to report in February 43, which miffed me a bit because I missed my birthday on the 28th of February.
November 42 was the Admiralty.
November, yeah, 42 was when I applied and was interviewed and subsequently made a member of the Royal Navy.
And then it
Reserve.
Was, it was a few months before yeah. You actually finally got
yeah, a couple of months, that was all.
But they, you mentioned earlier, they had already said to you, we're full up for pilots.
Oh yeah, I had to report as a trainee TAG.
Telegraphist
air gunner.
Telegraphist air gunner.
Navy has to be different. They couldn't be wireless operated air gunners, no.
Basically, it was wireless, but it was just their terminology.
It's a much, much longer course than any of the RAF air gunners' courses. I mean, I think I was still training, I think, a year later. I was 6 months in Canada, over 6 months in Canada training. So the training was... much more comprehensive, both the flying part, but of course I was going to get round to it when I did report to HMS Royal Arthur, which turned out to be Butlin's holiday camp in Skegness. I'd never stayed in a holiday camp ever in my life after that. Those of us that reported, we suddenly found that all we were was part of a group that had been called up, and for 2 or 3 months we were in fact going to be trained for the Navy, because yeah, we were going eventually. If we did that efficiently, then we would be allowed to go off on our aircrew training. So for 3 months, it was seamanship, rowing boats, square bashing, and then suddenly, after I think it's about 2 or 3 months, we were split away and told, "Well, you've got to start your aircrew training now, and you'll be sent to HMS St Vincent in Gosport."
So, going back to this first. You get this letter, you say goodbye to your parents, train up to?
Yeah, well, they sent you a rail warrant, and you packed your little bag and got on the train.
And were there other people on the train going to the same place?
Oh, yeah. There's obviously a crowd of blacks were all in the same boat as me, because they had lorries to meet us at Skegness Station, and a hell of a lot. I think the train was full of people who were just about to be whipped into Her Majesty's forces.
What was the feeling? Can you remember the atmosphere on the train?
They were nearly, as far as I can remember, they were nearly all volunteers. So, yeah, this is it. We're in the war. And just to go and do what we wanted to do. And really, what all the Royal Arthur did was it sorted out the categories of blokes. I say we were already categorised as air crew, providing we did well at the seamanship training, which is strange, really. Yeah. But yeah, they're then designated off as whatever they might be, signalmen, wireless operators, ordinary seamen, stokers. From there, they were sent to their various bases to learn their trade.
And at this former holiday camp, were you in dormitory? Was it sort of dormitory accommodation?
We had two to a chalet. Not, I don't think they say hot today, they were very primitive. And the amusing thing was, you were two to a chalet and you shared a double bed, but the Navy, in its wisdom, had put a plank down the middle of the bed so that no naughties could go on. It seems strange. So two to a chalet, and you had your own wash basin there if and when it worked. If you were clever enough to have taken a plug with you, because the plugs always got stolen. Most of us weren't even shaving properly, yeah, but again, there's one side of a little bit of bum fluff. You know, take this man's name, make sure he shaves tomorrow.
And what were you issued with as soon as you arrived?
Oh, issued with all the usual. Yeah, you start off dental examination. Haircut, of course, doesn't matter how short it was, you had a haircut, dental, and then medical, and then, of course, the dreaded jabs against God knows what. And then they had a very good system. After you had the jabs and your arm was feeling like hell, they decided they'd teach you how to lash up a hammock. So there you were, pulling on ropes, learning to... We didn't actually sleep in hammocks, they taught you how to roll them up and lash up. You probably heard the naval expression lash up and stow. That does date back to a lot of people slept in hammocks on board ship during the last war, but the hammocks have to be lashed up with these ropes and stowed in special stowage places, because in the event of the ship getting hit and water coming in, hammocks flying about all over the thing would get in the way. It would cause, they couldn't get to stop up the holes or whatever was going on, so stowage of hammocks was very important. So you were taught to do that. We also taught to wear this most peculiar uniform the Navy had in those days, trousers that didn't have fly buttons, had a flap which you had to undo each other and drop down, these very tight jumpers with a V and a sort of a collar, you know, which had to be put on the outside and tied up inside, and things like lanyards and silks. I don't know what. I think the silks were supposed to be to commemorate the death of Nelson or something.
What was the silk?
It's a black silk. It went down under your collar.
Like
a scarf. Yeah, like a scarf as part of your uniform. Most strange. Plus, of course, the inevitable wood boots that didn't fit and crippled your feet. It was a general inception course, I suppose, into the ways of the Navy. And I must admit, I mean, most of us have gone there to be air crew, thought, where is the glamour of all this flying? Yeah, this is not what we came in for.
So how long were you at this training camp?
2 months.
So can you describe to me a typical day? What time?
Yes, you were formed into classes. I mean, oh, Reveille, dreadfully early, about 6 o'clock in the morning, Reveille.
How were you woken up?
Loud noises over the tannoy, bugles and wakey, wakey, wakeys, and all sorts of rude things were said. Actually, I won't repeat, as it's going on record. And if you still hadn't got up, large gentlemen appeared sort of at the doorway holding wooden clubs and hammered on the door and hammered on your bed and told you to get out of bed.
And this was the training staff?
Yeah. Most of the training staff were retired regular Navy people, ex-chief petty officers that had retired from the Navy and were called back for wartime service but were deemed too old to go to sea. So they had the job. I mean, we had we had this old chief PO in charge of our class, and I don't know why we called him Jumper, because he was so miserable. Somebody said, oh, he jumps for joy, and he graduated in the name of Jumper. But he was, on reflection, he wasn't a bad old boy, you know. Perhaps he wasn't very happy about being called back to the colours either. But yeah, then did square bashing.
That's the drill,
foot drill, rifle drill. Much more religious, I think, in those days than now. You always started the day with an assembly type parade where prayers and said by the chaplain. Sunday's church parade, swimming in Mr. Butlin's pool, which was absolutely freezing at that, because it's now getting into February, March time. It's freezing cold.
Was it open air and outdoor pool?
And you were issued with these white duck uniforms, which were absolutely stiff as cardboard. In order to soften them up, and to see whether you could swim in clothes, you were told to go in the pool in these white ducks, which are dreadful.
What is a white duck?
For tropics.
A tropical
but
uniform.
I mean, it was like white stick canvas. Eventually, I suppose the theory is, I never wore mine. I mean, I suppose the theory was, it was old Navy tradition. You know, you had to have a white duck suit for the tropics.
Do you know why they were called ducks? Because ducks are white. Was duck the nickname?
I don't know, just known as your white duck suit. But so they were like, it's like wearing a cardboard, I suppose. For regulars before the war, they probably used to wash them and wash them and wash them until they became soft.
So they thought to soften them, they may as well do your swimming training wearing
clothes. So you're really being assessed. Could you swim in clothes? You know, everything was an assessment.
And could you swim at this time?
I could swim quite well at that time. I'd swam quite a lot at school and in the scouts and so on. So,
was there anybody there in the training that could not swim?
Oh yes, there were guys that couldn't swim. And, they had a very good cure for that. They used to chuck them in the pool and say, "Now learn to swim," which wasn't very kind. But nothing was very kind about that place. In between, we had to do fire watching duty on the roof. Butlin's. It's a vast camp, and they had these huge, I suppose where the campers used to dine and eat, and they turned it into dining rooms for the, and there were hundreds and hundreds of trainees there, and they had flat roofs, and we used to have to do fire watching duty on the roof. Am I allowed to sort of talk about a little bit of a naughty? It's not too bad, but one of the duties we had to do, I can always wipe it out, I suppose, can't you?
No, carry on.
Well, one of the duties when you're on fire watching was it was very vulgarly called the piss the bed party, and there were certain blokes who joined up who had this terrible problem where they couldn't hold their bladders at night, and you had to go around their chalets every hour and wake them up, and this was a most make sure you woke and they woke up and they went to the toilet, and if you didn't then you were in trouble yourself. It was the most unpleasant job, because you imagine the places used to pong a bit, and whether it ever cured them, I don't know.
So you would go around and just prod them or give them a knock, yeah?
Oh, shake them until they got out of bed and went to the loo.
And it was your job to make sure they weren't
in
the loo.
Fortunately, it wasn't a duty you got terribly often. Everybody tried to dodge it.
And your issue, you said you did some rifle drill. What rifle were you issued with?
Oh, old Lee Enfields. No, just the normal slope bombs, left, march, right, belt turn.
Were you taught to strip and clean and to fire the rifles?
Strange enough, no.
It was just purely for drill purposes?
Purely just for drill purposes. All our weapon training came later. But, it was really purely preparation, as I say, and I suppose really it was a summing up or a checking up on people's capabilities, and because that was the whole idea. So afterwards they just transfer them to the poor chaps couldn't say, "I want to be a stoker," or "I don't want to be a stoker." Right, you here to the left, you're stokers, bonk, you report to so-and-so Portsmouth, Naval Barracks Portsmouth. Somewhere else they go for radio training, somewhere else for seaman training and bunting tossers, which are blokes with flags and telegraphists for radio training, and they all just got hived off, you know.